All right, if everybody's got a Bible with them tonight, what are you doing? Oh, whatever. Pink lemonade, I see. Lovely. If everybody has a Bible tonight, if you want to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 16, we're going to continue on our study through 2 Samuel. 1 and 2 Samuel were both one book in its original form, but after the Greek translation of the Old Testament, they split it into two. 1 Samuel kind of deals with the story of Saul, the very first king over Israel, and how he fell from grace and God removed him. 2 Samuel kind of deals with David's rise to power and how he replaced Saul as king. God prophesied about him, calling him a man after God's own heart. And we've seen how he's been a really interesting example. Sometimes he becomes an example of us as a Christian. Sometimes he's an example of Christ. But either way, we see this shadow of the way things are going to be. We see this shadow of a life to come. And it's very interesting. So to really fully grasp where we're at in the story right now, I need to give you some quick backstory because we missed last week. We're out watching fireworks and stuff, which was a lot of fun, by the way, but we're back now. So we've been dealing with the revolt of Absalom. Absalom was David's son, and he killed David's firstborn son and had run off and fled and lived in exile for a long time. And David finally brought him back into the kingdom. And when he brought him back, well, it turns out that Absalom had become a rock star. He was really handsome and had long hair, and everybody loved him. And so he was beginning to steal the hearts of the people. And so we saw step by step how Absalom actually came to a position where he began this revolt that we read about in last chapter, where he was going to usurp his father's kingdom, take his dad's kingdom away from him. And so as he was getting closer to Jerusalem, David and his men conferred and looked at this and saw that they were losing numbers too rapidly, and he didn't want Jerusalem to become this battleground where everybody was going to get slaughtered. So he said to all of those who wanted to follow him, let's bolt, let's get out of here. And so they gathered up their people and they took off. And so that's where we left off last time. David and those who are loyal to him are heading out into the wilderness, and Absalom has come into Jerusalem and gone and taken the throne. And so that's where we are. David, you know, if you remember, David had fallen into sin back in chapter 12. And it was a terrible sin. It was in terms of scales of things, it was a bad situation that he'd gotten himself into. He had an affair with one of his soldiers' wives, and so she got pregnant, and instead of coming clean and repenting and doing anything right in the situation, he sent his soldier out to the front lines where he knew he was going to get killed, and so became responsible for this man's death just so that he could have this man's wife. And so the Lord confronted him and told him, trouble is going to follow your kingdom. Trouble is going to follow your household. You brought trouble to somebody else's household, it's going to follow you. And so we've seen how this has been happening for David. Even though God loves him, even though he's restored to the Lord, even though, you know, everything's right between him and God, he's still facing some of the consequences of the sin that he committed. So now here we are in chapter 16, and we'll begin just by reading. I just want to start with the first couple of verses here. When David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, what do you mean to do with these? And so Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and the summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink. Well, this is so nice. I mean, you know, here you are, you're going out, you know, facing some really difficult situations here, some difficult terrain ahead of you, and you've kind of had to leave the city in a hurry and everything, and all of a sudden you see an old friend show up. That's who Ziba is. Ziba is the servant of Mephibosheth. And I don't know if you remember back in chapter 9, we dealt with this wonderful story where Mephibosheth was this child of Saul. He was one of Jonathan's sons who had been dropped when the Philistines were coming in to invade the territory where he was. And when his nursemaid ran away, she dropped him, and he was crippled. He was lame. And he was the last remnant of Saul's household, the deposed king. And instead of going in and destroying all the last remnants, all the last males of that family, family. David looked around and said, who can I bless? You remember this story? Some of you were here. And it turned out to be Mephibosheth. And so Mephibosheth thought he was going to go before King David to receive the judgment. You know, he was from a fallen household. He was crippled. He was a beautiful picture of us. And instead of judgment, instead of retribution or anything like that, David showed him mercy and brought him into his own household, made him one of the family. He said, you're going to eat at my table from now on. You know, when we have Cheerios, you'll have Cheerios. It's going to be great. We're going to, you know, hang out together. You'll be one of the family. So it was a beautiful story. So here his servant is meeting David on the mountaintop right outside of Jerusalem as they're heading out of town. And he's got all these cool supplies with him, you know, raisinets and everything that they need. And so it's very generous. I mean, this is, you know, I'm sure it was a sight for sore eyes to, you know, to come up to the top there and find this guy waiting for them with all these supplies and all the things that they're going to need. And so that part of it is really wonderful. Then we get to the next couple verses, 3 and 4. Then the king said, and where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he's staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, oh, I humbly bow before you, that I might find favor in your sight, my lord, O king. Oh, doesn't that, I mean, here you hear about everything that happened with Mephibosheth, all David did for him, showed him this kindness, and now you read something like that, isn't that disappointing? I mean, you look at that and you think, man, how could he do that? Well, if you were disappointed, was anybody disappointed at all? If you were, have heart, because it turns out Ziba is not a good guy at all. And he's actually telling a fib here. He's lying about his master. And we'll find out about that when we get to 2 Samuel 19. I'm not going to jump ahead there and see it. You can find it there. It's in like 21 to 23, I believe. But you'll find out. We'll find out that he's not telling the truth. Ziba is up there and he's looking at this crisis situation and he's come up with a plan, come up with a way that he can actually advance himself in the middle of this crisis. So he goes up there behind his master's back. He goes up with all of these supplies, and he looks to David like, you know, I'm here to really help you out. My master, he's no good. He didn't want to come. He's going to, and he made it look like Mephibosheth is waiting for David and Absalom to tear each other apart so that he can suddenly rise to power. He's the last remaining heir of Saul, and so he could have taken power and called and restored Saul's kingdom, and that's what he makes it look like he's trying to do. But what Ziba's trying to do is actually take all that Mephibosheth has. He's trying to do his own little power play and line his own pockets in the process. And so David, right there on the spot, strips Mephibosheth of everything that he gave him. All that I gave to Mephibosheth, I'm going to give to you. David didn't, you know, you figure he's in the middle of this problem. He's already had his trusted counselor betray him. He's got all these people that used to be his friends are turning against him. So we cut him a little bit of slack, but it is too bad that he did this. He didn't confer, you know, he didn't try to shoot off an email, get a confirmation on this, is really what you think or whatever. Didn't ask anybody else. He went totally solely on this one person's counsel on the matter, and he strips Mephibosheth of everything and he gives it to Ziba. Ziba is a great example of human nature, the way, fallen human nature, the way it will move in there in the middle of a crisis and immediately think of how it can benefit self. We see that happen all the time. I mean, you know, you'd look at, remember Katrina when that was going on, all the different people that began moving in there, trying to rip people off in the process of pretending like they were there to help people. And, you know, that sort of thing happens on a regular basis. This whole attitude of trying to advance self and trying to get what, you know, what self can get in the middle of the thing. It doesn't matter what cost it is to other people. And so here Ziba shows his true colors. He's not a good guy at all. And that's kind of too bad. Verse 5. Now, when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there, and he came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men that were on his right hand and on his left. Also, Shimei said thus as he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue! The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you've reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you're caught in your own evil because you're a bloodthirsty man. Okay, how interesting. What a poignant scene this ends up being. I mean, when you think about it, David spent a good majority of his adult life out in the wilderness. I mean, he was on the run from King Saul, who was out to get him for no good reason, just because he was nuts. And he was jealous of David. And so David had to spend all this time with his mighty men running around, fleeing for their lives, living on whatever they could. And when he finally gets to come back to Jerusalem and he reigns for however many years it is, then all of a sudden he's faced with this situation where his own son, his own flesh and blood, is rebelling against him. And now here he is with all his guys heading back out into the wilderness, going back, right back into the same boat that he had been in before. And so, you know, the first guy that he encounters ends up being a crook. He doesn't know it, but he's just been, bamboozled into doing something evil against somebody who didn't deserve it. And now as he gets to Bahurim, he's just the first thing that greets him there is not, a cheering crowd saying, David, we're with you, or it's all right. Nobody's running up to him with a glass of iced tea saying, it's all right, David, we're with you, patting him on the back or mopping his brow or doing anything nice to him at all. What does he meet when he first gets there? This screaming maniac who's throwing rocks at him and calling him names. You talk about insult to injury in a situation like that. You talk about a downer. Obviously, he surely knew that the stones aren't going to hurt David or anything like that. He's not really trying to do any kind of physical damage in the process of this. You even notice how it describes, he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men that were on his right hand and on his left. So, I mean, the ludicrousy of the situation is made known there. He's got his soldiers, his bodyguards all around him. And this guy's up there throwing rocks at him, jumping around like a monkey. So, I mean, he's clearly not trying to cause physical harm. He can't. There's no way that he can. This is annoying. This is humiliating. And that's what this is designed to do. It's designed to show Shimei's total and utter contempt for David. In spewing out this kind of language and in saying these insulting things and throwing rocks at him, it's to show to him that he feels like David is getting what he deserves. And he feels like David is a cast down king. I don't know if you remember back when we went into Iraq and into Baghdad, and you remember when they pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein? You remember what the people did all around there? They were all yelling at it and hitting the statue with their shoes and doing all the things that within that culture would have been a terrible disgrace to the image of the man whom they were, hating at that time. And they tore the statue apart and dragged it around. Well, that's the same kind of attitude that's present here. Shimei obviously has harbored an awful lot of ill will towards David. I guess everybody's got to have a hobby. That must have been his. He clearly had been waiting for this moment, and there's always people like that sitting around waiting for something like this to happen to whatever leader it is that they don't like or candidate that they don't like. They're just waiting for the scandal to hit and things to fall apart. And this guy was waiting for that to happen. And obviously he's been brewing about this because he was at one time part of the royal dynasty. He was part of the royal family. I mean, he could have run in circles and he would have made it clear to everybody around him, yeah, I'm part of the royal lineage. I'm part of the king's family. That's, I'm somebody. But then when Saul gets deposed and David takes the throne, now all of a sudden he's a nobody. So he's sitting out in the outskirts of Bahurim, this little town just outside of Jerusalem, fretting and stewing and angry at King David. So finally when the news, he turns on CNN, he realizes David's leaving. He's like, all right! And he's running out there waiting at the at the turnoff at the exit lane, and he's throwing rocks as David and all his guys are coming down through there. I mean, it's a terrible scene in so many ways, but it's just one of those things that proves one more time that no matter how down we get, there's always somebody who will be there to kick us when we're down there, and that's what this guy is here for. He's sometimes that happens in life, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it feel like that sometimes? Sometimes we go through things and we're struggling with things and one event happens after another and we're looking around for somebody to be a friend to us or to help us, and instead we find somebody who just wants to throw rocks at us and kick us while we're down. Job found that. Job, in the story of Job, here's this wealthy guy who, for no apparent reason, he didn't get to read the first part of the book like we do. He had no idea that in the heavenly realm, comes, you know, this debate is going on, and he ends up being the subject of it. He's just having a good day one day, and all of a sudden, boom, everything falls apart. And so when his friends come to visit him, oh, well, thank you. My friends are finally here. My friends are going to lift me up and help me. They come saying, you know why this happened, Job? Why? Why? Because you're so evil. And they go on, and they start ladling all this guilt on top of Job, and, you know, wretched friends are you, is what Job ends up saying. So, I mean, that's one of those kind of things. You know, what do we do in situations like that? You know, sometimes we find ourselves in bad situations. Sometimes we find ourselves the target of somebody's criticism. Someone will be upset with us, or we'll be at odds with someone, and someone will begin to speak about us, or be criticizing us, or different things. How are we supposed to respond? Because, you know, that's not an easy thing to deal with when somebody attacks us like that. That's a hard thing to kind of to struggle through. Well, what we need to do is we need to look at David's response, because when we look at David's response, once again, we're getting one of those glimpses into this new way to live that the Bible informs us about, that was typified in shadow in the Old Testament, that was revealed to us perfectly in Christ. And here we see a scene where David's going to reveal to us how we can respond, how we live in the midst of a crisis like that. Here we begin with verse 19. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please, let me go over and take off his head." And the king said, "What have I to do with you, the sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David.' Who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" And David said to Abishai and all his servants, "See how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? Let him alone. And let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursings this day." And as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed him as he went, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust. Now the king and all his people who were with him became weary, so they refreshed themselves there at Bahurim, in other words. All right, so Abishai is, you know, one of those captains in David's armies. We've seen him before in action, and he's kind of a hot-headed kind of guy. He's a quick-to-act kind of a guy, and he obviously did not enjoy this. I mean, this, to him, was extremely insolent behavior coming from this little peasant sitting outside the town throwing rocks at him. It could be that, you know, he just really felt a lot of loyalty to David. He's looking at him saying, you know, "David, you shouldn't have to go through this kind of stuff. That's not right." Or it could be that, you know, he's associated with David at that moment, and he's tired of dodging rocks coming down out of him. He's thinking, you know, why? What are we doing here? Can't we, you know, these guys are armed to the teeth. They're guarding David. This guy's got rocks and, you know, and cuss words. That's all he's got. And he's thinking, this is kind of dumb, isn't it? Can't I? I'll do it. I'll do it right now. No problem. You don't even have to bother yourself, David. I'll take care of it. But David says to him this amazing thing. He says, no, don't do that. Let him curse. Let him go ahead and speak his mind. Let him say what it is that he wants to say. David does not try to shut Shimei up. And, you know, by all accounts of justice that we can muster up in our own hearts and minds, that doesn't make a bit of sense. I mean, it seems like it makes a lot more sense to go ahead and just say, yeah, take him out. This is ridiculous. I shouldn't have to put up with this. I'm innocent. He's accusing me of stuff that's not right. I mean, you know, it's interesting to me that this is how David responds to this. And these are lessons that we can learn. David didn't feel it was necessary to react to or try to stop these unpleasant and even critical words that were being directed towards him. I think that's really interesting. He was willing to listen to that. And you notice what he's saying in this is he's talking about it. He's making some assumptions here. He's thinking, well, maybe the Lord's put him to this. And it's interesting what he's doing here. He's saying, in essence, in this, go ahead and let him keep speaking his mind, because it could very well be the Lord is trying to tell me something through this. What an amazing point of view to have. I mean, that's not easy. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but that's not easy for me. I mean, you know, negativity or critical stuff comes my way. My first response is, well, we got to set the record straight here. We got to take care of this, blah, 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 blah. But from David's point of view and what he's revealing to us, what God's revealing to us out of this Old Testament example is this new way to live, this way that we'll look at this and say, well, maybe there's something I can learn from this. Maybe God is going to speak to me through this. Maybe there's some way in which my character will be refined in the process of this. That's an amazing response from David here. I mean, he's following suit, really, with James's instructions that he provides in James 1:19, where he says, therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Those are important things. Those are important words that James lays out. This is an important moment in David's kingship. All of these things that David has been going through. It's interesting that he's back out to the wilderness out here where the Lord is going to teach him some more things. You know, he was trained to be a king out in the wilderness. Remember, we talked about that. The Lord had him out there. He was unjustly persecuted by Saul. And he laments a lot. And we can go through the Psalms all over the place and see all the different ways in which he lamented about that and cried out to the Lord and cried to the Lord for mercy and for strength. But yet in all of that, all that was happening there, God was refining David's character so that David was going to be ready to be a king when the time came. And once again, God, after David kind of falls out with the Lord in his practices there, then the Lord allows him to be put out into the wilderness again so that once again his character can be refined and God begins to work on him. See, not all the negative things that come our way are necessarily things that are sent to us with evil in mind. Maybe there was evil intentions in the process of it. Maybe our enemy is at work thinking he can destroy us. But Romans informs us that God works through all things for the good of those who love him. And I think that we've got to be careful sometimes that we don't run around starting to rebuke different things that are negative within our circumstances or our experiences as though, you know, we've been wronged and everything must be righted. Sometimes we need to be quiet and listen and look at this and think, is the Lord trying to communicate something to me? Is this something that's going on that's going to help refine my character? What will I learn in the process of this? Doesn't mean that we can't believe the Lord for escape from that. Obviously, a way of escape is made for us in any temptation or trial. But it does mean that we want to be, like James tells us, slow to speak, quick to hear, especially as it deals with our relationship with one another. I mean, you know, the first response of our normal human nature is to react and to set the record straight. We're going to correct everybody. We're going to, like David's soldier wants to go take off his head. We want to take off people's heads, at least with our words. We want to at least, you know, stop the source of this annoying speech. We'll take off that part of the body anyway, because it's bothering us or whatever. You know, it's interesting. Shimei's accusations are not true. As we look at it, you know, we know that David is reaping some of the things that he's sown. But even still, even there, as his enemy is out accusing him, the accusations that he's bringing against him are not true. Though what he's saying there, even though David is assigning it to the Lord, and it doesn't necessarily mean that's the Lord doing it. That's just representative of David's heart. He's willing to listen to it in case the Lord is trying to say something there. But the accusations, you know, he says he calls David a bloodthirsty man. I mean, that's a weird thing to be saying to a guy who's walking past you armed to the teeth and you're throwing rocks at him. If he really were a bloodthirsty man, Shimei wouldn't have been here to tell this story, or we wouldn't have known anything about it. I mean, so obviously that wasn't true. But David lets Shimei speak because he believed that God is working in all things. And you know, that's an important thing for us to understand in living out this new kind of life that we're given as Christians. To remember that God is at work in all things. He's working through all things and in every circumstance. Whether it's good or whether it's bad, God is at work somewhere in that. Oftentimes, that's what we have to do. When we're faced and confronted with difficult things, that's really what we want to do first, is look at it and think, well, what's God doing in the process of all of this? What's God up to in this? Knowing that he's in control, knowing that he loves us, knowing that he's got a plan and a purpose for all things. And you know, if Shimei was supposed to be shut up, David is thinking, well, you know, God's well able to do that. God's the one who gives us the breath to do this. And if he didn't want Shimei saying this, he could easily take that breath away. So that wouldn't be a problem. In fact, what I think is interesting here is David puts the Shimei problem in perspective. He looked at this as part of a bigger picture because, you know, he says, my own son. In essence, what he's talking there, and he's saying, my son from my own body, he's saying, my own son, my own flesh and blood is out to try to kill me. I mean, he's out trying to take my life. And if he's not been able to take my life, if he's not been able to accomplish this sort of thing, then I'm not going to worry about this guy with rocks and cuss words. There's nothing that I have to fear about that. If God didn't let me be taken down by my own son who had the power to do it, then how is this dude going to hurt me? And he's also seeing this in light of the real story, the way it goes. The real threat to David is Absalom. The real enemy at work here is someone else, not this guy who's throwing rocks and cursing him as he walks along. And again, that brings us back to the important lessons that we've been learning on Sunday mornings as we've been going through the Word. We have an enemy. We do have an enemy. We don't ever want to forget that. We've got an enemy who is actively working against us to undermine our walk and our journey with Christ, but that enemy is not a human being. That enemy is not a person at all. That enemy is Satan, this spiritual force, this spiritual entity who's fallen from God. Whatever that story is, we're not privy to the details of it, but he's at work against us, and we know that. But the people around us, the people who may even be used at a time to say things or hurt us or do things that we didn't want to have to experience, they are not our enemies. We have no human enemies. People may think they're our enemies, but they're not from our perspective. And that's what David is kind of putting together. I got an enemy, but it's not him. It's not this guy. He also lets Shimei speak because he knows that God's in control of his future, of David's future. He knows that God's well able to protect him. He doesn't have to try to defend himself. He's going to let God defend him. He even says that. It could be that the Lord will look on me kindly for this. If I watch how I respond, if I'm careful about this, if I let the Lord go ahead and refine my character and change me as I go along, then I'll be walking in a way that sets me up for God's favor, for God's blessing on me. And not that our works are going to earn God's favor, but when we're walking in harmony with the character of God, it changes everything around us. And that's what he's trying to say in this. You know, it could very well be that the Lord is going to take care of these things for me. So I don't have to try to mess with this. I don't have to try to take this guy down or straighten him out. To me, this is a good pattern for us to follow as believers in Christ, as those who have embarked on this journey of a new way to live in Jesus. This is a great thing. When we find ourselves subject to someone's mistreatment or critical words, this is a pattern that shows us a different way to live, a way to live that makes room for God to work so that we don't have to get in there and control things. We don't have to worry about what somebody says or if they'll say it to somebody else or anything like that. We're just going to follow God in all of this. We're going to keep our eyes ahead, following David's pattern here. Just looking on ahead to the place of refreshment that we're going to go to. We're not going to worry about all the dust and the stones coming down on us and the cuss words echoing off the walls. We're just not going to worry about that kind of thing. It's quite a picture, really, of intentional humility, like we've been talking about in Philippians. You know, this same kind of concept where here, this is King David. He could have easily taken control of the situation. He could have grasped the throne and said, I don't have to put up with this sort of thing, but instead he willingly lays that aside, lays aside the privileges of his kingship, and he moves on in the midst of all of that. That's the same kind of thing that Christ did in laying aside the privileges of his deity, coming down and walking among us, and then taking the blame for things that he never did and suffering in the place of the guilty. So, okay, so this is the story. This is where David is at. He's out in the wilderness, heading back out to Bakurim. They're going to go get a shower and everything else because they're tired and they're weary, and we see them heading off. And so then we kind of, as we're going through the text, now we have to say, meanwhile, back in Jerusalem, verse 15, it says, meanwhile, Absalom, and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. And so it was when Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" And so Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why didn't you go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, but whom the Lord and his people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be, and with him I will remain. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I've served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence." Okay, so if you remember, Hushai wanted to go with David. He was one of David's servants, and he met him out there as they were getting outside of the palace and all. And he said, "I'm going to go with you guys. You know, this will be cool. I got a tent. I got all that stuff I need." And David says to him, "No, you don't want to do that. It's actually better for you to head on back in there and stay in the palace and actually be a counselor and actually help to, you know, even frustrate some of the counsel Ahithophel is going to be giving to him." Because remember, Ahithophel was David's closest counselor. He was like this guy that spewed wisdom all the time. Everybody thought he was awesome. He was amazing. He was like Gandalf or something. He was always saying the right thing. And so when Absalom was coming, Ahithophel left David and said, "I'm going to go serve Absalom." So it was a terrible betrayal. And so this is what Hushai is supposed to go back in there and help try to frustrate some of that counsel. Well, you know, when Absalom sees him, he comes walking in saying, "Hey, king, how's it going? You know, long live the king." And Absalom is immediately suspicious. You see that in the text there. He's looking at him saying, "Well, why aren't you with your friend, David? You know, why aren't you out there with him? I thought you were faithful and loyal to him. Is this the way you're supposed to treat him?" And it's interesting because Hushai's answer isn't necessarily an out-and-out lie, but he's certainly not revealing, you know, what his motives are or anything like that. He's not being completely upfront, in why he's there. He says basically, you know, "I'm a royal servant. I'm gonna be serving the king. Who am I supposed to serve if I go out in the wilderness? I should be serving the king. That's what I do. That's what I was trained for. That's what I went to Ivy Tech for. I know how to serve kings. And now you're the king. Everybody's made you king. And so I'm gonna stay here and serve you like I served your father." So, I mean, he is there to do that. That's what David sent him back to do. He's just not revealing. And, you know, "I'm also going to be here to frustrate the counsel of your other counselors," or anything like that. So, I mean, you know, he's going on. What he's saying is true. He's saying, "I'm here to serve the king." But you can just not imagine that he turns around, he cocks one eyebrow, and like any good spy would do, and he marches away, you know, dun, 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 dun. So that's, you know, that's his whole deal right now. So then we get to verse 19, or verse 20. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give advice as to what we should do." In other words, you know, what do we want to do now? And Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines whom he's left to keep the house." Remember when David fled, he left 10 ladies there to housekeep, you know, clean the place or whatever, and thinking they were going to be safe. "Go to your father's concubines whom he's left in the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. Okay, so Ahithophel advises Absalom. You know, Absalom's saying, well, you know, he's sitting around on the throne, and you know, he's been playing with the king's PlayStation and all the different things. He's running around the whole place and making it his own. And then he looks at his counselor and he says, What do we do now? Now what do you want to do? And Ahithophel is thinking through a concept here. He's thinking, how are we going to solidify these clearly drawn battle lines? How can we keep this slipping back into a foggy sense of, well, who's right and who's wrong and who really is, you know, is supposed to be the king and who's stronger, et cetera, et cetera. And he thinks, I'm going to come up with something that he's going to do that is going to just be shocking to everybody. I'm going to have him do something that is just going to send out the message that will strengthen everybody's resolve in terms of their polarization. Those who hate Absalom are going to hate him all the more. Those who are with them are going to feel emboldened and strengthened. Man, if he's out doing that, it shows he's never going to reconcile it with his dad. So this is it. This is the new regime, and we're going to follow with him. And so what he tells him to do is go sleep with these ladies. Now, you could think, oh man, that's a terrible thing to do. And it is a terrible thing to do. But it wasn't even just the sexual sin aspect of this that was the issue at stake here. When anybody, and we found this back in Genesis, when Reuben went and slept with his father's concubine, the concept behind that is it is a power play. If any man were to go and take the woman and sleep with her that belonged to the king or the royal head of the home, he is, you know, he's taking something that belongs to the royal household in an intimate way. I don't know how else to word that. It doesn't get embarrassing, but he's violating something that belongs to the king, but you have to understand, I'm thinking in terms of the patriarchal concepts and the misogynist kind of viewpoints of that time. He's violating this that belongs to the king, this person that belongs to the king, and so it's a power play. It's usurping his role as king. It's taking from him the most intimate thing that he can take from him and making it clear that he is the one who believes he's going to be in control. So that's what he's going to do. And so, you know, they put a circus tent up on the top of the roof there, and he goes up there and in the sight of all of Israel. We don't know what that means, and I'm sure it's not, you know, it was, well, I have no idea. There's no possible way of knowing. We weren't there, and there's no way, but obviously everybody knew what was going on, why he was up there and what was happening there. And so it sent the message loud and clear. David is gone. I've taken what is his. I am now going to be king, and we will never be reconciled. This is going to be a matter of life and death. One of us, you know, only one of us will remain. And so that's what the message in all of that is. Now, if you remember back when David fell into sin and the judgment that was pronounced on him, God said to David that when this judgment happens, that they were going to come and take his wives from him, and they were going to publicly be violating. You took somebody else's wife, I'll take your wives, and they'll give them to strangers, to your enemies. And then he said that you did this in secret. He said, you did this secretly, but I will do this before all Israel. And so this guy's counsel that he gives, you know, is extremely wicked counsel. I mean, it's a terrible thing. You talk about the ultimate betrayal of David in this. I mean, he clearly is sealing his fate. He's burning his bridges behind him. And yet, in this counsel that he gives, he ends up, even in the midst of his wickedness, he ends up fulfilling the prophecy that God spoke against David. It ends up being, it's just the same way in which, like, Caiaphas spoke, saying it's better that one man should die than the whole nation perish. He was speaking a prophecy. He was speaking something from the Lord, even though his intentions, his heart was wicked in the process. So here we see a case like this happening. This guy giving counsel, and he's doing a terrible thing, but it's fulfilling something that God said that he was going to do. So Absalom, what we're being told in this text, to the short of it, is Absalom is just no good. He's just not a good son. And so he's going to ultimately see how this plays out, and it's not going to be a pretty picture when all is said and done. But David, we've left David off in the wilderness. He's trusting in the Lord. He's putting up with things. He's practicing intentional humility. Absalom, his son, on the other hand, is going out in extreme arrogance and violating everything that is right and proper in order to establish his kingdom, and we'll see which one prevails. So, Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you that it expounds for us the amazing truth of the new life that you've given us to live, this brand new way to live, a way that just seems to violate our rational thinking sometimes. It seems to violate all those things that we've held to so tenaciously about justice and fairness and all these things. And yet, all through your word, you keep revealing these things, that justice is in your hands, and you're going to take care of it in your time and in your way. But if we will humble ourselves and follow you and trust in you, you will work, and you will reveal yourself and reveal yourself in power in our midst. So help us, Lord, to learn these lessons. Help us to follow this pathway. Help us to follow not just King David, but King Jesus in this intentional humility that will save not only our lives, but will save the lives of those around us. We pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Any questions or comments about this tonight, Ben? Sure.